Hello, everyone. Welcome to the fourth episode of the AJSP Editors Podcast. This is Kim Pon Tem, the host of the podcast. And we also have two more hosts here, Angela Leung and Sammy Kang. As you may already know, this podcast series is a new initiative we started around maybe 8, 9, or 10 months ago. We do 4 episodes in a year. And this episode we are regularly listening now is the 4th one in a year of 2021. We have 2 objectives in this series. First, to introduce publications in the journal to the global psychology or social psychology community. Second, to nurture the next generation of Asian social psychologists. And to achieve these 2 objectives in each episode, we have 2 sections. The first one is editor's pick, and the second one is special topic discussion. Without further delay, let's begin with the first section, editor's pick. So in the editor's pick section, we basically will, you know, the three of us, right, read the papers published in the very recent issue of the journal. And then we, among the papers published there, we pick one for kind of more elaborate discussion. And the paper we're going to discuss today is picked by Angela. And the title of the paper is Effects of Competence Information on Perceptions of Warmth. I will pass the time to Angela to kind of summarize the paper and also explain why she picked this paper for discussion today. Hi, Angela.
Thanks, Kevin, for the introduction. So the title of the paper is Effects of Competence Information on Perceptions of Warmth by Fei-Fei Chen and Tian Yuan Gao from University of Macau. So let me brief you, talk about the background of the research and then summarize the 4 studies. Competence and 2 traits that people form judgments about individuals and groups. And based on the stereotype content model first proposed by Susan Fisk and colleagues, people form group stereotypes or impressions on 2 major dimensions. So those are competence and warmth. And it is quite common that competence and warmth judgments are negatively associated with each other, such that people are weighted as warm but incompetent or competent but cold. And usually research examines judgments of target pairs. In such a comparison context, when one target is judged to be warm but less competent, such as older people, the other target is judged to be cold but more competent, such as female leaders. And the paper we are going to talk about today did not examine competence and warmth perceptions in a comparison context involving 2 targets, but only 1 target. The research involved a set of 4 experimental studies examining how exposure to information about a target's competence will affect the perception of the target's warmth. And the authors predicted that competence information will positively predict perception of warmth. And it also aims to find out whether interpersonal attraction can serve as the mediator that explains the positive relationship between competence and warmth. And according to the authors, interpersonal attraction is about people's immediate positive responses to a target. As people are attracted to a competent target, such higher attraction will then facilitate the perception of high warmth. So that's how the authors define interpersonal attraction as a mediator. So the 4 studies recruited participants from Macau or mainland China. They employed a 2 experimental design manipulating either high or low competence about the target. And in study 1, participants read information about a target having high or low competence and then weighted the target's warmth. As predicted, competence positively predicted perceived warmth of the target, and interpersonal attraction mediated the positive relationship between competence and warmth. And study 2 tested an interesting proposition that high competence will compensate for an initial perception of no warmth of a target. In study 2, participants first read information describing a cold target. Then they learned that the target is either high or low on competence. And interestingly, results show that after learning about the target being very competent, participants increased the warm perception towards the target. However, if they learned that the target is not competent, the initial perception of low warmth did not further decrease, possibly because it has already reached a floor effect. And study 3 is sort of a mirror image of study 2. It tested whether low competence can drag down the initial perception of high warmth of a target. As expected, Low competence of the target made participants rate targets becoming less attractive, which then lowered the perception of warmth as compared to the initial high perception. And the study ended with study 4, which further confirmed that interpersonal attraction can account for why competence increases perception of warmth. Prior research suggested that the positive relationship between competence and warmth is a result of the halo effect, which is about how perception of a specific quality of a target helps people form an overall positive or negative evaluation about the target. And this overall positive or negative evaluation that informs the perception of the second quality. For example, if a person is judged as competent, the overall impression is already positive. Therefore, the same person is likely to be judged as warm too. The final study established that besides this halo effect explanation, interpersonal attraction is also another explanation for the positive link between exposure to competence information and warm perception. So that is about the 4 studies in this research paper. And I think there are at least 2 things I like about this paper. And then later on, I can ask Kevin and Sammy to share with us why they also like. So I think the first thing I like about this paper is it is novel because prior research, as I mentioned, examined competence and warmth judgments in a comparison context. So people have to evaluate 2 target persons or groups at the same time. But this paper took between target approach to examine how competence judgment of the target affects warmth judgment of the same target. It allows us to examine the spillover effect, whether the exposure to competence information can negatively or positively spill over to perception of warmth. And the second point I like about the paper is I really think that it's very interesting to examine the dynamic information about competence and warmth perceptions. An initially cold person can be judged as less cold after knowing that person is competent. And similarly, an initially warm person can be judged as less warm after knowing that the person is not so competent. So this suggests that people's first impression is not so fixed. They can actually constantly update the social judgments by registering new information. So I think that kind of provides some new insights about how people form the first impression, and it's actually not that static. People can constantly update the information to change the first impression. So these are the 2 things I think the paper are quite interesting. So I guess I can pass the time to Kevin and Sammy. Maybe you can also share with us why you like this research paper. So maybe Kevin first.
I agree with Angela's observations about the paper, the strengths that she just pointed out. I just want to add one more thing, and that is the writing. It, from my own reading, I think the writing is very neat and clean, particularly in terms of introducing the theories behind the introductions. Very easy to follow, highlights the issues being investigated, and then, you know, and then offer the different perspectives, in particular, right, the halo effect or the interpersonal attraction mechanism, and how either or both could explain the effects of competence information on warmth perception. So I like I think the introduction part, no, does a very good job in terms of introducing the research question, the theoretical issues involved, and then how the authors came up with the hypothesis. I think that type of neat and clean writing is something that I, as a reader, not just as a viewer or as an editor, also as a reader, I really like to see, right? Sometimes I run into papers with very interesting topics, methodologically very rigorous, but somehow quite difficult to read. It takes a lot of time to just understand the author's intention and the motivations behind the study. So this is one thing I recommend about this paper. And maybe one more thing is the method. There are in total 4 studies, as Angela just kindly summarized for us. And the use of different manipulations is something I like as well. In particular, I like study 2 and 3 very much because it kind of examines how people's impressions of a person may change, right? As a result of receiving information, like when the person is portrayed as a cold person, but you're later receiving information about the person being competent or incompetent, the perception of this cold person may change accordingly. Right. So that's unlike something that you're looking at person perception in a very static manner, right? You just present a information about a person, then you ask the participants for the impression of the person. So this design is interesting in the sense that it captures how a person's impression of a person may change as a function of the old and information the person receives. So that's another thing I really like in terms of the methods. Yeah. How about Sammy?
I think I agree with your respective assessments. I really noted, and the word neat is really one that stood out to me, both in the introduction and in the procedure in particular. One thing that I really liked about the paper is that it's truly embedded within social psychological theory and literature. And it, as Kevin said, it does summarize actually decades of research into this topic in a very clear and coherent way. I think sometimes with four-study papers, and it being a four-study paper is another strength, of course, but sometimes with multi-study papers, it can be hard to follow all the manipulations, what it is that's different between one and another study, actually what the variations are, whereas in this paper, it was very easy to follow.
And one more thing I just want to add, just upon what Sammy just commented, the whole thing is easy to follow, the procedure is explained very well, and the study is complementary to each other very well. And one thing I want to add is that the authors actually provide information about their methods and actually share all the data on OSF, right? It's an open science practice that we really want to encourage all authors to adopt. And the authors did that. And so you can also find all the items that they use, the scenarios that they used in all four studies in a supplementary document they put on OSF. And also that makes reading the article more easier, right? And then if you don't want to replicate the study, you have the materials already. You can easily do that with these openly shared data. That's something I also want to commend the authors for. So we have been talking about the strengths of the paper. And of course, no research is perfect. So how about areas for improvement? So Angela, do you have any thoughts to share with us?
Certainly, there are always room for improvement of every research. So for this set of studies, I would be very curious to know if warmth information can similarly affect competence judgment. Because across the four studies, the participants were exposed to competence information, and then we see whether they affect the warmth perception. So I want to see whether similarly, if the reverse can occur, if people are exposed to the warmth information, can it also affect the competence judgment? So I think that can be one thing the study can add on. And then another suggestion I think that the authors can consider is they can better distinguish the mediating mechanisms. Because according to them, there are two mediators, right? Interpersonal attraction. And halo effect is about forming overall positive or negative impression of the target, given the initial information received. However, this overall impression can also mean seeing the person as interpersonally more or less attractive. So as I see it, it seems two mediating mechanisms of halo effect and interpersonal attraction may be somewhat overlapping. So if the authors can better differentiate these two mechanisms, I think it will benefit the paper more. So how about Sammy? Do you have other things to add with regard to how to improve the paper?
On my notes here, I thought as well, testing it the other way around was one comment that I had. I would like to see it within the same or a similar paradigm, examining the effect of warmth on competence. What I thought was a weakness in the study, no research is perfect, is that I would have liked to have seen at least one of the studies conducted in an applied context. So I think all four studies were actually conducted with university students. So it would have been nice if one study was conducted in an applied context, perhaps an organizational context with a focus on, let's say, prospective employees and or managers or something like that. I think that would increase the external validity of the findings. I thought again about person perceptions versus group perceptions, whether or not the effects actually would generalize on a group level, whether or not it would lead to stereotype disconfirmation or some type of subgrouping or subtype. So I thought about that because I think a lot of the research on competence and warmth, at least according to the stereotype content model, has been based on group-based perception. So I thought about how would that translate into group-based perception, but that's not really a limitation. It's more about how things may play out in a completely different context. one thing that I also would have liked to have seen in the paper is perhaps some more guidance to the how to interpret the figures, because I think perhaps they weren't always the easiest to follow for perhaps a naive reader who isn't familiar with mediation analysis, etc. But I think still, nevertheless, that's just being picky. I thought that actually within the parameters of the paper, they were able to actually communicate the information very clearly, but I perhaps would have liked to have seen one or two more figures in the manuscripts, and perhaps those figures that were presented in the manuscript interpreted on the behalf of the readers, or at least that there were some guiding notes as part of the figures. Another thought that's more about future research, I thought about the domain specificity. I know that the authors talk about that in the discussion about which domains is this about. I mean, what about domain generalization? So I always talk to my students, for example, about self-esteem and being domain specific. And I always give the example of me being perhaps quite competent at teaching and research, but not so competent when it comes to home improvements. Actually, I'm very incompetent when it comes to home improvements. And how about generalizations between domains and what effects they may have on person perception, whether or not certain domains of competence weigh more or way higher than other domains of competence in terms of generalizing to warm, and perhaps the other way around as well.
For me, I agree with the very interesting comments that Angela and Sammy just made. If I'm to add one more thing about suggestions for improvement, and obviously this is the representation of the over-representativeness of the sample, it's also this use university students in Macau, right? So it's a highly specific group of individuals geographically, demographically. So obviously, it will be very important to consider how the findings may play out if, you know, another age group or another culture is used, right? But of course, this is a very convenient comment, right? Basically, you can make all papers, right? Because, you know, as researchers, we know we always face constraints in terms of resources, and so that also reveal in what kind of sample, what kind of participants we use. But I think at the very least, it will be useful to discuss or articulate what the speculations about the pattern of your findings if, you know, the study is conducted elsewhere, and then kind of make some suggestions in the discussion. I think that will be quite useful, you know, something to add, right, for the paper or any paper, you could say. Yeah.
Yeah, I agree with both of you about the sample issues, because it's based on student samples and it's East Asian samples, because the students are from either Macau or mainland China. So it reminds me of potential cross-cultural difference. Previous research by Jude and colleagues actually suggested that there's a trade-off between warmth and competence. So if one group is judged as high on warmth perception, the other group was judged to be lower in warmth but high in competence. So it's a trade-off here. And it reminds me of some cross-cultural research on dialectical thinking and also tolerance for contradictions, right? So if East Asians have more dialectical thinking style and also higher tolerance for contradictions, so maybe they show less of a trade-off mindset when they make this kind of competence and warmth judgments. So it would be very nice to see whether the findings can be reproduced in another culture, maybe a Western culture. And also for student sample, they may emphasize more about competence because they are more achievement oriented or performance oriented. So if we have another sample that values social warmth more, would that also affect the current findings? So I think all these very interesting follow-ups inspired by the current research.
I would like to add something along what Angela just commented about the age group thing. I'm wondering whether it is theoretically interesting to have young people and the elderly as participants, and then compare how they behave in this experimental setup. The reason for including old people in the study as a separate group of participants is that the author's argument is that we are attracted to competent individuals, and as a result of such attraction, we tend to perceive these individuals as warm, right? So that's the argument by the authors. And I'm just wondering whether young people and old people are attracted to competent individuals to the same extent. Now, for young people, we are attracted to young competent individuals. It makes a lot of sense because it affords us a relationship that can provide support in the present and in the future, right? In a sense, it's kind of building some social resources when you get connected to a competent individuals. No. So that's an kind of adaptive behavior, right? To build your connection with people who are competent. So it makes sense for young people to be concerned about, you know, someone's competence and then be attracted to people like that. But if you follow a very important theory in the area of aging and psychology, the social emotional selectivity theory, for example, that as people, the theory states that as people age, we organize our goals, our priorities. So as we become old, we tend to prioritize things that are emotionally meaningful and over those things that are future oriented, right? Such as acquisition of skills or acquisition of knowledge, etc. So it is possible that if you extrapolate from this theory, that for old people, what's more important for them is not building resources or social resources for future use, right? Because their goals are less future oriented, given that they have limited time, right? And maybe they'll actually prioritize relationships in which they can enjoy safety and security. Because comparatively, you can also say that older people are relatively more vulnerable. They may be dependent on others, right? Given their physical needs, etc., or economic needs. So to them, competence is not the primary determinant of attraction. Maybe warmth is, or maybe something else. So in that case, if you compare young people and older people in terms of how they respond to someone or how they perceive someone who is competent, maybe young people would be attracted to these people and perceive more warmth in them. And comparatively, maybe old people would not be that attracted to these people. And as a result, would not perceive more warmth in these individuals. So I think, so if you expand the age range of the participants and then kind of integrate this thing with the social emotional selectivity theory, I think that would be a very interesting direction for the future research. That kind of, you know, is in line with what Angela was saying about the use of different age groups as participants for as a future expansion of the study.
Yeah, and apart from age groups, as Kevin just suggested, maybe different professions can also make a difference. Like people in the caregiving professions, they may actually value warmth more, value security. So apart from age groups, it will be very interesting to kind of extend to other groups of samples, such as different age or professions, or even genders. So it will be very interesting to expand on this area.
So thanks, Angela, for picking this paper and also sharing her views. And also thanks, Sammy, for the comments on the papers. And of course, we always end with these comments. No, as the editors of the journal, I encourage you to read all papers in the published issue. We just picked this one. No, this maybe this particularly more interesting, more things that we can discuss here, but it doesn't mean that the other articles are not as interesting. So I really encourage listeners, readers to explore the issue. There are many other interesting papers in the journal, right? So let's stop here and we'll be back for the second section, the special topic discussion. Okay, hello everyone, welcome back. So here we're in this special topic discussion, the second session of our episode today. The topic we've chosen today is something very important to consider, right, for all researchers, and that is the peer review process. As we all know, the peer review process is basically the foundation of the rigor and objectivity in scientific research. And it is a collective process. It requires concerted efforts by not only authors, but also reviewers, editors, and even publishers, right? It is a collective process. As far as I know, our experience can tell, some people, particularly early career researchers or students, they may not understand peer review process very well. All right. One thing I can share with you, I just read from the website of our publisher, Wiley, which reports that in a survey they conducted with close to 3,000 researchers, right? So they asked them questions in the survey about the peer review process. And one question they asked is, would they like more training about the peer review process? And 77% of these surveyed researchers expressed that they would like more training, right? And this percentage went up to 89% if you count only those early career researchers. But even among those who were established researchers, 65% of them expressed that they would like more training, right? So it seems that there's a lack of training or there's a need for more resources about the peer review process. So that's one of the reasons why we have chosen this topic to discuss in this episode. And I think it's particularly useful, obviously, for people who are relatively new in scientific research in psychology, like first year PhD students, or maybe even someone who are in their early career. They just received the very first request for reviewing a manuscript from a journal, right? So how to approach a review like that, right? So there are a lot of issues around the peer review process that are worth discussing. And so that's why we have this topic, special topic discussion about peer review process. Unlike the previous episodes, we don't have special guests today. I think all three of us are very experienced in terms of publishing papers as authors, in terms of reviewing papers as peer reviewers, and of course, in terms of handling the peer review process as editors. So we will take out this special topic discussion today and share with you what we know and our experiences, etc. Now, I just want to start with a very, very brief introduction of what the peer review process is like, right? It starts with, of course, a submission from an author to a journal. And when the paper reaches the journal's editorial office, usually it is the chief editor who will read the paper first and make a very quick assessment. In our case, in Asian Journal of Social Psychology, this role is played by me, Sammy, or Angela. So we read the paper and basically determine and make an assessment whether the paper is qualified for a peer review, or we think that it is not qualified. Sometimes because of the poor quality of the articles, or just because the paper doesn't really fit the scope of our journal. In that case, the paper will be desk rejected, right? So when a paper is considered to be qualified for peer review, then we will send it to one of our associate editors who will handle the peer review process. And what the peer review process looks like, usually it will be the editors who are sending the papers to experts in the field, sometimes two, sometimes three, sometimes more. Depends on situations, depends on journals. And that's inviting these people, these experts, to review the paper. And when their reviews come back, the editor will make a decision whether the paper is accepted for publication or rejected, or they may want a revision and resubmission. And they will send this decision to the authors of the paper. The revision and resubmission, obviously, the authors can choose to further work on the manuscript, revise it to address the comments received from the reviewers and the editor. And then we submit it for another round of review. And that would eventually lead to publication of the paper or maybe rejection of the paper. So that's how the peer review process looks like in a very brief sense, right? Now, and obviously in this peer review process, for most of us as researchers, the most relevant part of it is that, as an author, right? As an author, as someone who conduct research and write up a paper and you want to publish it, how you should approach the peer review process as an author, okay? It's more complicated than it seems, right? Maybe you just think, okay, I just write up and send it. What's the complication in that? Actually, it's more complicated than just that. So there are a lot of issues to consider, right? As an author, how you should approach the peer review process. So that's something we are going to discuss now, right? Some good practices or recommended processes for authors, okay? How they should approach the peer review process, okay? Maybe we can start by discussing how an author should prepare a manuscript for submission, okay? Of course, when you submit the manuscript, you expect that your paper is good enough for peer review process. So when you submit it, you expect that you will be read by someone, okay, by the peer reviewers. So at the stage of writing up the manuscript, is there anything that you can do to make it better, to give it a higher chance of passing the peer review or getting more positive feedback from the peer reviewers? Sammy and Angela, do you have any kind of ideas or advice to share with our listeners? Maybe Sammy first.
Read the submission guidelines first and foremost, and the formatting guidelines, I think, is very important. Most importantly is actually figuring out one's audience, whether or not one has written a paper for the right journal, being familiar with the aims and scope of the journal that one is considering to submit a paper to, being somewhat familiar with the type of topic. So it's about picking an outlet and an audience for it. And I think reading the submission guidelines and actually really sticking to them. I don't want to get into how one should structure a paper in its entirety, because I think that becomes another topic in and of itself. Right. But I think sometimes the devil is in the detail. And I think sometimes there's something about a paper that is submitted where you can see that the authors actually have been really conscientious in the way that they have formatted the paper, how they're presenting the different components of it, the analysis, tables and figures and so on and so forth. That actually makes a difference, because first impressions matter. And I think sometimes I have managed and I've reviewed papers that are actually really good, but it's really hard to overcome the fact that there has been some, in my opinion, for lack of a better word, sloppiness in actually formatting the papers and actually like presenting things in a coherent way. So for me, I think it's really important to take some time when the manuscript is written, actually take some time, perhaps let it sit for 1 or 2 days, go back to it and make sure like, well, actually, have I formatted everything really correctly according to the submission guidelines? Are there things that are perhaps missing? And just making sure that all those details are in place. And I know sometimes we are under pressure to submit a particular paper by a particular date. And sometimes that may be important, but if it is possible, it is my recommendation is sometimes to take that extra 1 or 2 sessions to just really review the paper to make sure that there aren't any formatting or obvious mistakes and taking time to address them. I think that final polishing, fine-tuning of the manuscript shouldn't actually be underestimated.
Yeah, I totally agree with Sammy's point. When I first received a manuscript, before doing anything, I actually will skim through the paper to see if the format is done correctly, whether the authors pay attention to some details, like whether the references are done right format, whether the tables are structured according to APA style. So I think these very important things are to tell us whether the authors take the paper very seriously, whether they take a very meticulous approach when they prepare for the research and also prepare for the paper. So I think these can be very important signals for the editor and also for the associate editor and also reviewers to show them whether the authors actually pay attention and treat the research seriously. So I would greatly encourage others to pay attention to details about formatting, about structuring the paper to form a very good first impression. Apart from the formatting, I think another important thing, relatively more attention to, is the introduction of the paper. Because that is, of course, the very first part of the manuscript that editor and reviewers read. So you have to make sure that the introduction is well structured. So I think the most important thing I always tell my students is that after reading the introduction, the reviewers and other readers should have no problem understanding your hypothesis. So I think you can use that as a standard to tell whether the introduction is written clearly or not. Right? So if after reading the introduction, people actually don't understand the hypothesis, then I think the introduction really doesn't do its work. So I think it's very important. You have to provide the background necessary for the research. And then after reading the introduction and the literature review, readers and the reviewers have no problem interpreting and making sense of your research hypothesis. So I think that is a very important thing to keep in mind when preparing for the introduction of the paper.
I agree with you too. I think making your best effort to present a good impression to your reviewers, right? And that reflects in, you know, on one hand, right, to what extent you have complied with the journal's submission guidelines and requirements, like the formatting, etc. And also, of course, on the other hand, is the way you structure the paper. Is it something easy to read, right? Your paper is going to be sent to someone in the field, the peers, right? Peer researchers, right? Supposedly, they know very well what you're studying, right? So you, of course, you have to make your best effort to make sure your stuff is clear enough, easy to understand, of course, theoretically important enough. And one more thing I want to add is about the complying with the requirements of a journal. It's obviously not, it's not just the format, right? Although we were talking about format. For example, in recent years, more and more journals now requiring information along the line of open science, right? For example, our journal currently requires a statement, three separate statements about pre-registration, statements about openness of your research materials, and a statement about openness of your data, right? So these, you have to provide these statements when you submit to the journal, right? And you have to take this serious, right? Because these are the reflect values of the journal. So if you really want to, your paper to be published there, you should follow these policies of the journal. So I think in a nutshell, you don't just submit your paper to a random journal, right? It's a very careful deliberation process behind, right? To find the right journal and then tailor your manuscript, making sure it complies with the journal's scope and aim and the requirements. And of course, the quality of your paper should be good enough. It should be easy to read, et cetera, right? Now, that's the first stage, right? Even before submitting your manuscript, there's a lot of things you have to do. Now, as an author, right, you submitted the paper already. And of course, you are waiting for the decision from the editor, right? There's a, it sometimes takes very long. It could be months. For some journal, it could be weeks, right? Now, and then after the long waiting, the decision comes, right, from the editor. You got this email from the editor already. Now, basically, there are three possible outcomes, right? Acceptance, which is good, right? That's the starting point of celebration, right? The paper is accepted, so you can just go out, have fun, and then celebrate with your friends and families. That's good. So that's nothing to, not much to discuss, right? When the paper is kind of accepted. But then I think the more interesting case is, how about rejection? The second possible outcome. How to cope with rejection, right? And of course, the third possible outcome is the revision and resubmission. How to deal with it, right? So let's talk about rejection first. I personally, I'm quite sure Angela and Shami also share this experience, being rejected by journals, right? Happens many times, right? And of course, there are also papers that we have that have been rejected a couple of times and then eventually published, right? It happens to us. It happens to anyone, everyone, okay? So the question is, how should we approach rejection? It doesn't mean the end of your research, obviously. It doesn't mean the end of that specific manuscript. There's actually a lot of things going to happen even after the rejection. Sammy, in general, maybe you can share with us your experience, how an author, how a researcher should approach a rejection decision. It's hard to take, right, being rejected, but what can we do? What is more positive way of coping with it? All right, so Sammy?
As you said, rejection is always hard, and it doesn't matter which domain of life we're talking about. So it doesn't just come to academic publishing. But I think in academic, if one is invested in an academic career, one thing one needs to get used to is rejection. But I think the important thing to remember is that actually rejections are the norm. It's not the exception. So if you are being rejected, that is actually the norm. Even being invited to revise and resubmit a manuscript isn't necessarily the norm. It's actually also an exception if we're looking at it statistically speaking. And I think it is very important to learn to manage rejection. I think initially it's really hard, the first couple of rejections. I think I was spoiled because I think the first paper I submitted in my career actually got an accept with minor revisions. And I thought, well, this is easy. And then after that came all the rejection. So I had to learn the hard way, I think, by being rewarded early on. And I think the key is to not take it personally, because it isn't personal at all. It could be a range of different reasons for why a paper is rejected. If you find it hard initially to deal with the rejection, my recommendation is really to just leave that email for a couple of days and just accept the fact that it's been rejected and then revisit it. Carry out your life as usual and then go back to the email when you're in a better space to deal with it and actually think about it. I mean, of course, there may be a rejection without feedback. And if there is a rejection without feedback, I think there is very little you can do to necessarily improve the paper. But often what happens is when we submit a paper, we typically, well, certain improvements, possible improvements come to mind. And you think that, oh, actually, I should have put it this way. Actually, I should have perhaps included this figure or so on and so forth. And I think What happens when you're rejected without feedback is that it gives you a perfect opportunity to make those small improvements to the manuscripts that came to mind after you submitted it. I think that that's important, that we don't become despaired, that we don't become too personally frustrated or so on, and that we actually just take it as a natural part of an academic career. Or, I mean, if you look at, for example, someone's Google Scholar profile, what we've got to keep in mind, so we may look at a Google Scholar profile and we may look, oh my God, they've got an amazing H index and they've got 100 published papers. But that means that they probably have 500 rejections that underpin those 100 published papers. And I think if rejected with feedback, it, in my opinion, is actually the second best outcome of the peer review process. The best outcome being having a revise and resubmit, because actually being accepted at the first submission is generally quite unlikely. It would happen, it's very rare. So if you actually are rejected with feedback, actually you should value that, because you've actually received independent feedback on your paper, on your research. I mean, yeah, of course, rejection, again, it's not great. But if I get feedback on it, either from the editor or from the editor and reviewers, it means that actually it gives me something to work on. And I may not be ready to work on it then and there, but actually when I've given it some time and I've read the comments a couple of times, tried to make sense of them, the case that they're trying to make, it gives me a really concrete direction as to how to improve the paper. And that's really the way to look at it, is that it's peer review. So think of them as being peers who are giving you feedback as to how you may go upon improving your paper. An important aspect of that is to understand that most reviewers have actually taken time out, if you receive feedback, to review your paper. And it's important to take that feedback seriously, because just submitting it to another journal is unlikely to result in another outcome. Because if there are obvious limitations in the paper, other reviewers for another journal are likely to pick them up as well. I think it's very important to actually address those and actually see it as an opportunity to further improve a paper.
Yeah, just listening to Sammy's sharing, I was kind of recollecting, you know, the papers I've ever published, and I can see quite a substantial proportion of them were actually rejections in my first or maybe second attempts. And that's exactly in line with what Sammy just said. You just, you know, put it, no, just leave it several days and come back and then read and take it professionally. Consider how you can improve your paper, and actually will give you a better chance of, you know, success when you submit it to another journal, right? Angela, anything to share from your side?
I think I can agree more about rejection is so common, right? I think all the journals have, I think, about 70 to 80% rejection rate. I think the same for AJSP as well. So definitely rejections are more common than revise and resubmit or acceptance. So it's really a way for you to learn from the process. And I treat it as a learning opportunity, right? Because in a review process, at least, right, two reviewers and one editor give you feedbacks. Although it's a rejection, it's always come with feedback and suggestions. So I often treat it as a way to improve the paper. And when I think about my previous publications, actually the two publications I feel the most proud of in my research career were actually rejections at the first place. So the two papers I like very much were rejected by a pretty good journal. And I got a lot of constructive feedback from the reviewers. And with this feedback, I was able to improve the theoretical model, refine it, add more data. We go back to rethink about the framework and try to have more data. We collected more studies. Actually, for these two papers, I went back to the journals that rejected me at the first place. And eventually, it got accepted. So I think it's really a learning kind of process to really benefit from the feedback and the suggestions. And of course, these rejected papers to the same journal that rejected me, I have to explain very clearly to the editor that this paper was actually previously submitted to this journal and it was rejected, but now it's totally brand new paper because we substantially revised it and we added a few more studies. So you have to explain to the editor very clearly that it was submitted before to the same journal and now it's a new submission because it's tremendously rewritten. So that is one thing you may consider in the future if you think that your paper has potential, right? after receiving the reject, if you think that based on the feedback received from the rejections, you have quite high confidence, right, to revise it and make it much, much better, you can consider submitting back to the same journal that rejected you. And of course, you have to explain to the editor what is going on, and you have to describe the process and how you improve the paper. But that could be one thing you can consider if you have this same experience as myself, like rejected by the same journal, but you are very encouraged by the suggestions and you want to try again the same journal, because maybe the journal is a good fit to your research and you think that by improving it, it will still be a very good paper that matched the journal. So you may consider this route if that happened to you. And of course, feedbacks may not be very positive because it will point out all the limitations and weaknesses of the research, but treat it as a learning process. Don't be disappointed by it, because you have to appreciate also the reviewer's time that are put into the review process. You can easily think of like reading the paper will take about like at least maybe 2 hours, 2 to 3 hours, and then writing the review letter will take another 1 or 2 hours. So it's like a few hours of work coming into this review process. So instead of being disappointed, on the other hand, like you should feel grateful, right, about all this time and effort that the reviewers and the associate editor put into handling the manuscript. So maybe this kind of switch of perspective can help you better cope with the rejection and then better prepare yourself for improving the paper for a later submission.
Yeah, I agree with you that a more positive mindset, a more learning-oriented mindset, a more appreciative mindset really helps. After all, reviewers are, they're not paid, right? They are volunteers to give comments on your paper. And as an author and submit papers to a journal, if it is sent for peer review, it's basically you can receive feedback from someone who have the expertise free of charge, right? No cost at all, right? And you can benefit yourself. You can improve your paper by working on these comments, right? That's a really good thing about the peer review process. Now, we have talked about, you know, how to approach the review process even before submitting a paper and how to cope with rejection. And then, of course, another big thing about the peer review process from the author's perspective is an hour now, right? It revise and resubmit decision from the editor. So that means the editor send you the comments and then kind of encourage you to revise your paper accordingly, and then we submit it to the journal for further consideration, right? That's of course, a positive outcome. That means your paper is still in the process, right? So how should we approach, you know, as authors, how should we approach this peer revise and resubmit decision? What is the more positive way or better way of, you know, working on the revision and respond to the comment? Maybe Angela first, do you have any insights to share with our listeners how to approach an hour and hour?
If you receive an hour and hour, I think it's something that you can celebrate, right? Because that is really one step closer to having the paper published. So it's really something that you can feel happy about it. And of course, like after feeling happy and have a little bit of celebration, you should right away start on the revisions, right? So I always tell my students that once you have an hour now, maybe you can actually prioritize it to finish the revision first, because that will actually help you like get the paper published earlier. So it's important that you prioritize revisions more than other ongoing work. So that can actually like make it earlier for you to get the paper published. So I think the important thing about doing revisions is you have to take very seriously the reviewer's comments and suggestions. It's very important to prepare a detailed response letter to address each and every one of the reviewer's comments and suggestions. The response letter should be point by point. Usually, I just copy and paste the review letter and then add in the response under each of the comments of the reviewers. So this will give them a very detailed report of how I respond to their suggestions. So it's important to provide this kind of detailed report. And even if sometimes you don't agree with their suggestions, you should still explain why. Like you should justify why the previous approach is better than the new approach that you suggested, and provide enough suggestions, enough justification, because you shouldn't just ignore the reviewer's comments and and say, oh, the previous approach I use is better than yours. You shouldn't say something like that, right? You should adjust the response, explain why this new suggestion may not work. Because you are the researcher of the work, you may actually have a better position to understand why the previous methodology or approach is better. So I think the important thing is you explain why with enough justifications. And I think many reasonable reviewers will take it. Right? They will understand the reasons and then support your final decision. So it's important that you don't ignore them, even if you don't agree with their suggestions, and try your best to provide sufficient justifications and prepare a report that is detailed enough to react to each and every one of the suggestions.
I think writing this report, it takes some time, right? And that's something you have to put effort into. Like when you resubmit your manuscript, it has to come with a detailed letter or report on how you respond to each of the comments. And interestingly, in some of the papers that I have handled, either as editor or reviewer, the authors did not submit a report like that. So that makes it difficult for me as an editor or reviewer to understand what revisions have been made to the manuscript, right? And obviously, as an author, you're doing yourself a disfavor if you don't submit something like that, right? I think within the mindset to adopt is that you're trying to have a conversation with the peer reviewers. You're trying to convince them you have addressed their comments already. And if this is a conversation, of course, you have to make yourself clear, right? And in this case, of course, it's a letter, it's a document that point by point explain clearly how you respond to each of the comments, right? So you have to also pay some effort into writing up this report and also formatting it in a way that is easy to read. And I also agree with Angela that you should not ignore a comment just because you disagree with it, right? You have to address every single comment. If it doesn't make sense, if it's not reasonable, if there's some misunderstanding by the reviewer, you just explain, right? And not to confront, right? You're trying to convince the reviewers. You're not trying to confront them. Because sometimes when a reviewer misunderstands some part of your research, of your paper, it's perhaps because of your fault, because you didn't write very clearly enough. That's why the peer reviewers misunderstood the paper, right? So it's not always the fault of the reviewers misunderstanding your paper. Sometimes it's just the problem of your own writing. It's just not clear enough. So take that comment seriously and think about, is it a problem of myself? Is it a problem of my writing? Can I make it clearer? And at the same time, you explain and try to convince the reviewers that there's not a problem there, right? Asami, anything to share from your side?
Yeah, I think I agree with all the points that have been made, and I suppose there will be some reiteration here. I think it is very important. As we talked about with rejections, with comments, I think it is really important to thoroughly engage with the comments that have been made. And not to avoid them, comments that we don't agree with or don't understand. And equally important, not to be defensive about anything. Again, it's not personal. People have taken, other academics, other peers have taken time out to ideally or hopefully thoroughly engage with your research. And even though they may not think about the research along the same lines as oneself does, where they're often coming from is a legitimate perspective. So if they're misunderstanding something, it doesn't mean that they're actually misunderstanding the research topic. They're just misunderstanding the way you or oneself as an author has actually presented the research topic, because they're thinking of it from another perspective. Again, coming back to what Angela said, we don't have to agree with everything, but we have to provide good reasons for the things that we don't agree with. So we need to put forward a case for that. And the key here is to be constructive throughout the process and to be very precise about how comments have been addressed and or not been addressed. Revising a paper takes time. And I think the worst thing as an editor, but also as a reviewer, is when authors don't actually take the comments that have been made seriously. And we have to understand here that there's a significant amount of time being dedicated to a particular paper by the editor and the reviewer. So it takes us time to pre-review the paper before we send it out to an associate editor. Then the associate editor has to find appropriate reviewers, recruit them, invite them to actually review the manuscript. And the reviewers take a substantial amount of time to actually review the manuscript. And then actually the associate editor again have to make an assessment of those comments and take a decision. That decision is often reviewed by the editor-in-chief. So there's lots of hours there being dedicated to any given manuscript. And actually, if the associate editor takes a decision of revise and resubmit, again, coming back to the idea that rejection is the norm and revise and resubmit isn't the norm, it actually means that they've given the authors a real opportunity. I can't stress enough how important it is to take that opportunity seriously and really see that as a genuine chance of actually being published in the article. Now, there's nothing worse, in my opinion, than authors that are quite blasé about it, that they just go like, yeah, I just need to do a bit of this and a bit of that, and then it's done. And it's not that simple. You really, as an author, have to show genuine engagement with the comments, that you're really understanding where the reviewers or the associate editor is coming from and what type of improvements they're wanting to see in the manuscripts, really trying to understand what the issues are that they've identified and how they would like to see them addressed. Again, impressions matter. If you get back a resubmitted manuscript and as an associate editor reviewer, you see that they haven't really engaged with it. Actually, if you're already kind of on the borderline of if let's say the associate editor has taken a leap of faith in the sense that chances are uncertain as it stands, and actually the resubmission or the revisions aren't substantial, it may be the case that actually the reviewers and associate editors will become immediately negatively inclined towards the paper because they haven't shown engagement with it. Hmm. So I think it's important to keep in mind here that as soon as one receives a decision of a revise and resubmit, it puts you in the exception category. It means that you're one of the very few manuscripts that have proceeded to that stage of the peer review process. And I think it's important to cherish that and really value that and really engage and respect the time and effort that's been put in by the associate editors and reviewers by respectfully showing that one is trying to take all the feedback and comments on board.
I think one way of thinking about this is that, you know, the reviewers and editors, they are not obstacles to publication of your paper. They're actually by your side, right? They are helping you improve your manuscript. So in a way, you and the reviewers and editors are actually working together to make better science. So I think that's a mindset that would be quite useful. So that you should, of course, if they are not your enemies, they are by your side, of course, you should take care of, take their comments and feedback seriously and how you together can work together and make it a better paper, better science, and contribute to the community, right? So don't take this adversarial approach. Don't consider these reviewers' comments kind of as your enemies and standing between you and your goal of publishing papers. That's not really the case, right? They're helping you, right? They're voluntarily unpaid, helping you to improve your work. Now, so we have been talking about the peer review process from the author's perspective, right? How about reviewers? As I just said at the very beginning, some of our listeners, maybe they know they're still in their early career. This is the first time, or maybe the first couple of times of receiving a request or invitation for reviewing a manuscript. It's something very new to them. They maybe have some received training in writing papers, right? Publishing their work, conducting research, but now it's something new in their career, that is reviewing someone's manuscript, right? So how should we approach the peer review process as a peer reviewer, right? Of course, there are a lot of decisions to make. Of course, the very first decision to make is whether I should accept the invitation or not, right? But that should be relatively straightforward. If you read the manuscript, the abstract, you can see this to be relevant. You really have the expertise to respond to the invitation, then you go ahead, right? But then after accepting the invitation, right, you receive the manuscript, you read it. So what's next? What is the better way of writing comments as a reviewer? What is the better way of providing your feedback to the authors, right? So that's another issue I want to address now in the discussion before we go. Angela, how about you? What do you think about this?
I think being a reviewer is like a professional service that you can contribute back, right, to the academic community, right? Because as a reviewer, obviously you also are researchers, and that means you also publish. And this is a way of like giving back to the professional community. You submitted your paper and then reviewers review your manuscripts. Like, they provide you a lot of constructive feedbacks. And when you are invited to be the reviewer, it's the time for you to also give your contributions back to the community. You also play a part to provide feedbacks that can help others improve the research. So I think it's something that we can think about as like making contributions to the academic area, because we are also part of it. So as reviewer, I think the most important thing, of course, is to provide constructive feedback, helping them try to improve the paper so that the final publication will be much improved and it can make contributions to science. Right? So I think that's the important goal for being a reviewer. So you have to be clear about this motivation is providing constructive feedback to help the authors improve their research. And I think one maybe more like a practical suggestion to the reviewer is, I would think that it's better for the reviewers to provide feedback in the response, in the decision letter, rather than provide some recommendation whether the paper is rejected or not. Right? Because I think this final decision is better made by the associate editor instead of the reviewers. So I think it's important for the reviewers to understand clearly that the job is not to make a recommendation whether to reject the paper or accept the paper. So this recommendation, I would rather not put in the review letter. Instead, the review letter should be about your constructive feedback to the authors. So I think that would be something that I want to say with regard to good practices by the reviewers.
Yeah, that's something important to clarify, right? The role of reviewers and the role of editors, right? It's actually the editor who makes the decision, right? And reviewers provide comments and recommendations, right? Usually in the process, reviewers are prompted to kind of recommend it to the editor, right? But that's not something that the editor have to follow, right? That is basically use it just for reference. And I also agree with Angela that it's better for the reviewers not to put this decision into the letter, because that's not their primary job, right? The primary job is to provide comments to the authors. And if you have anything that you want to communicate with the editor, such as your recommendation, you can put it separately. Usually the system, there's a separate box in which you can insert your words or message to the editor. So that's a separate thing. When you write up your review, it's about communicating with the authors, right? And editors would make the decision taking into consideration of your comments and your recommendation. It is the editors who makes the decision. That's important to point out, right? And that's also important for authors to know, right? It's not the reviewers who make decisions, right? So sometimes when you read the reviewers' comments, you think it looks really positive. Why my paper is rejected by the editor? That's not really true, right? The reviewers simply come and write comments to help you improve. Whether it's the decision to accept it, reject it, or revise and resubmit, et cetera, is decision by the editor. That takes into consideration all the reviewers' comments, and of course, also in terms of aim and scope of the journal, et cetera, right? So the editors make a decision based on this collection of evidence and information. Yeah. We're back to the question about how to approach the peer review process. As a reviewer, Angela just shared with us her thoughts. How about Sammy?
I think I would like to apply the golden rule, that is, do unto others as you would have them do unto you. And I think that really the conclusion based on that is to be constructive. I think that even if we don't think that a manuscript actually meets the standards for being published in a journal, I think it's important to be destructive or not constructive in how we frame our comments to the authors and help the authors really understand the issues presented in the research and the manuscripts and possibly even how they may go upon addressing them. I then think it's also important to be very concrete and concise in the comments that we're making, avoiding sweeping statements. What is it that isn't up to standard and why isn't it up to standard? Highlight pages, paragraphs, and rows if possible. I also like reviewers who distinguish between major and minor issues. I mean, there are different ways of writing reviews, and some people go from sequentially through the paper, go from the introduction to the method to the results to the discussion. I think that's useful as well. But I think sometimes it's important from the perspective of an author and also from the perspective of an associate editor to actually be able to identify what the reviewer thinks are the major issues versus the minor issues. And major issues for me are more about argumentative logic and structure. Like Angela talked about the importance of an introduction. If the introduction is patchy, if it doesn't make sense, that's a really major issue in my opinion. And then there's also about justification of hypotheses and the choice of statistical analysis, validity, reliability of measures, interpretation of results. But also, I think failure when it comes to discussion to praise the limitations and implications and limitations of the research. Minor issues are more about unclarities or weaknesses to specific arguments, more minor arguments that could be made better. Failure to include particular details about methodology, statistical analysis, and for example, referencing, formatting, spelling mistakes. And I don't think that minor issues should be the basis of a decision that is made. I think that those issues can often be resolved. But on the other hand, if a manuscript is completely riddled with minor issues from beginning to end, there's just minor issue after minor issue, I think that is a problem. I think it really is, because that goes back to the submission process. It goes to show that actually the authors haven't really taken the submission as seriously as they perhaps should have done. What I really appreciate is reviewers that actually declare the aspects of the manuscript that they're not competent to assess. So sometimes often you get a paper and you manage to recruit a reviewer that has expertise in that particular research area, but they're not perhaps familiar with a sophisticated statistical techniques. And I really like when they declare, like, thank you for inviting me to review this manuscript. I can comment on all these parts. Unfortunately, I can't comment on the statistical analysis because it's beyond my comprehension. So that's something I really appreciate, because then you kind of know that, okay, I can rely on this reviewers for the theory and for the fit in the literature and the relevance of it for the literature, etc., and the argumentative structure and so on and so forth. But perhaps for the analysis, I need to get a reviewer who has that statistical expertise.
Yeah, I agree with every single point that Angela and Sammy just shared. I just want to add a few more points. One thing is that when you write up your comments, so whether you think that this paper is basically has to be rejected or not, or there's a chance for revise and resubmit, you basically approach it in the same way. So even though this, you think that this paper is not up to standard, is really poorly written, don't just write a short comment and just say it's not good enough. And then just because it's not good doesn't mean that you should not help, right? You should still try your best to help, right? Sometimes we say, for example, as a reviewer, you see a paper that obviously written by someone who is like a student, for example, and it's not publishable, obviously, right? You can tell from just reading the first several paragraphs. It should not stop you from writing a constructive comments. In a way, it's a way for you to contribute to community by helping the community to nurture these young and student researchers, right? That the fact that the paper is not publishable doesn't mean that it is not worth commenting on, right? So I think that's an important message I want to send to some reviewers, right? Even though you think very badly about the paper, so you try to give comments and help the authors improve and learn in the process. Another thing I want to make is that if you receive a request for review from a journal that you are not very familiar with, now sometimes it happens, then you have to make sure you understand the journal submission guidelines, the journal scope and aim. Sometimes it may involve reading some recent publications in the journal. So try to make sure you understand what this journal is about, particularly when you receive a request from a journal from a different discipline. Maybe your own research expertise, it kind of crosses several disciplines. Like in my case, I'm primarily a psychologist. Sometimes I receive manuscript to review from sociological journals, right? So you have to make sure you are familiar with how things work in that journal or in that discipline before you say yes or no. It also, of course, factors into how you write your comments, because you know that you are now communicating with a sociological audience, right? And psychological authors, right? That's another consideration you may need. And one last comment I want to make is that we have been talking about, Angela mentioned also that when we accept an invitation for review, we are kind of trying to contribute to the community, right? You're kind of making better science together with your peers, with other researchers, right? So but I also want to emphasize that it's not just about giving away being a reviewer. Actually, there's a lot of things to learn as a reviewer in the process, right? After submitting your reviews, the editors will make a decision about the manuscript, right? For most journals, editors basically will send you the final decision along with the comments by other reviewers to you, right? To the reviewers. So it is actually a very good opportunity for you to learn or to observe how your peers evaluate the same manuscript, right? So for example, you are among the three reviewers who reviewed the manuscript, right? So you can also see what the other two reviewers said about that manuscript, right? And that's actually a very interesting exercise as a researcher to learn, to observe how your approach to this manuscript in terms of the review differs or is similar to other people's approach to the same manuscript, right? So maybe you find out that other reviewers spotted something that you were not aware of. So you got something to learn that, in a sense. Or you found that the other reviewers expressed similar issues. So in a way, you found your own views kind of validated or affirmed by other people. So that process, just reading this decision by the editor and reading the comments provided by other reviewers in itself is a very interesting and very fruitful process, an exercise, right? So that's not really, that's true that it is about giving away, contributing to the community, but it's not a thankless job. It's not a paid, it's unpaid job, right? But you got something to learn in the process. Particularly for early researchers, this is a very rare opportunity, you know, in which you can learn from how other people evaluate the same research papers, right? So that's something you should pay attention to if you have a chance to review a manuscript. So watch out for these decision letter from the editor, read the comments by other reviewers and see, you know, observe the differences, observe the similarities, and then try to learn from the process. All right. Okay, so we have a really long discussion today, right, about the peer review process. There's still a lot of issues that we unfortunately haven't touched on. But I think if any listeners interested or have any questions about the peer review process, they want to learn more, just feel free to contact us. So we're happy to communicate with you through emails or other channels, right? So better stop here. Thanks again to all the listeners for listening to this episode today. And I hope you found something useful for you to approach the peer review process, either as an author, as a reviewer in the future. I'll see you in the next episode. Thanks. Bye-bye.